1935, Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson was an entrepreneur who wanted to start a comic book line. Comics were kind of a new thing as periodicals in America at that time, and most of the comics up until then were reprints of newspaper strips. And he was either too poor or too cheap, there are arguments both ways, or just not able to get the rights to reprint any of the cool newspaper strips. So he said, well, there must be some young people who would be willing to create these. So instead of paying the $5 a page or so that was the then going rate for the reprint rights, he was paying $2 or $3 a page, and he got young cartoonists, and New Fun Number One was the first regularly published all-original comic to hang around for a while. The Major was wonderfully prescient entrepreneur, had really good taste in some of the people he hired. His assistant editors on it included Shelley Mayer, one of the great cartoonists of the Golden Age, Vin Sullivan, one of the great editors of the Golden Age and a cartoonist himself, and Lloyd Jacquet, who was nominally the editor of that first issue, who also was the editor of the very first Marvel comic a couple of years later when he formed a company called Funnies Inc. and packaged that for the company that became Marvel. So DC and Marvel are kind of separated at birth with some common parentage, which explains an awful lot of the decades that followed of the somewhat loving and somewhat unpleasant sibling rivalries that have gone on. But I'm an only child. He knows much better about sibling rivalries than I do. You can stop by Paul's table and he'll show you some of his brother's art that he's selling. And I think he probably has in the refrigerated box below some pieces of his brother if you want to buy.
I actually have his ashes on my closet shelf at the moment. So, yeah, you're not far off.
I'm not at all surprised. I don't really want to know.
We got to get out to Long Island to spread them, but, you know.
One of the people that Wheeler Nicholson did business with was a printer and distributor named Harry Donenfeld.
Bum, bum, bum.
Who was one of the group of sort of first generation off the boat Jewish entrepreneurs who helped found a lot of the comic book business side of the industry. And Donenfeld, at that point, was in a number of different businesses. His printing press printed the covers for Wheeler Nicholson, his distribution company got the magazines to newsstands, and his other business was putting out pulp magazines like Spicy Detective Stories, which would have one or two pages of comics in them, and quite a few pages of photos of young women in outfits that these days you would think are probably too modest to wear at the beach, but in those days were Hustler magazine. Roughly at around this time, LaGuardia had taken over as mayor of New York. There was a LaGuardia before there was an airport. And one of the first things he did was to start an anti-pornography campaign. And Donenfeld and a number of his competitors were all in businesses that could be colorably defined as pornography by the community standards of the time. Of course, our conversation could colorably be defined as pornography by the standards of that time, too, because we might say a dirty word or two.
Like condom.
Donenfeld, like several of his peers, decided that the porn business, or what was becoming defined as the porn business, was too hot for him, and he had to move to something a touch more respectable. The really respectable parts of the magazine business were not available to Jewish people at that time, particularly immigrant Jewish people. So he moved up to this new thing that was starting called comic books, and joint ventured with Wheeler Nicholson on a new title called Detective Comics, and then ultimately either pushed Wheeler Nicholson into bankruptcy or conveniently took advantage of the trends that were driving Wheeler Nicholson into bankruptcy and bought out his line about 2 minutes before publishing Action Comics number one. That was the first one featuring Superman, and that's really what changed the business and what changed the history of DC. Okay, that's 3 years worth.
Yes. Well, and then came the 1940s. And all of a sudden, this this you know wacky little medium just took off. I think largely thanks to World War II, which helped you know spread comic books all around the world. You know, PXs would buy comics by the ton and ship them around the world for the soldiers to read. And you know, I mean, if you look around the world, you'll see like in the Philippines. There is an amazing amount of comic book artists that come out of the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And when you trace it back, you find out that the soldiers all left these comic books behind when they shipped out. And all these kids found them. And it's like, you know, they're very artistic. There's a very artistic, you know, attitude. And they,
A great sideline story about the Philippine studio. So, circa about 1971... DC began using the artists from the Philippines a lot. Now understand, this is before digital transmission. This is even before FedEx. One of my first jobs at DC as a young kid was preparing the courier package to go to the Philippines. This was a big damn deal because someone would have to literally carry it on an airplane to bring it back and forth with the scripts. The Philippine artists of the time thought they were ripping off these stupid Americans enormously because the going rate for a page of comic art in the Philippines was $4 a page. $5 if you were absolutely the Jack Kirby of the Philippines. At that point, the going rate in America was about $60, $50 a page. Neil was probably getting $65 a page. The American companies like DC were paying the Filipinos $17 a page. Filipinos thought they were ripping off the Americans totally. The Americans thought they were ripping off the Filipinos totally. It was perfect capitalism. Everybody had a grand time. But to your point about the artist pool, so Joe Orlando, who was my boss, one of the truly great artists and editors of comics history, went over to the Philippines to work with these artists and help bring them along into the studio. And he got into a conversation with the Philippine Minister of Culture, who, by odd coincidence, was a former comic book artist. Tells you something about where comics stood in Philippine status.
If only it would come out that Trump had drawn comic books, we could get rid of him completely. Yeah, because the public would not stand for that.
I think they're just a little too complicated for him.
Nah, that's true. He can't color inside the lines, if right, forget it. Anyway.
At any rate, can you tell where our political leads are? We thought you could. So Joe turns around and probably in slightly more politic fashion, but probably not too much more. He was a
blunt
character sometimes. He says, listen, you're this tiny little poor rotten country. How do you have so many wonderful artists? And the Philippine Minister of Culture, a guy named Malang, says, well, in America, you don't think everyone can be a mathematician, but you teach everyone how to add and subtract, multiply and divide. And in the course of this, you discover which kids have mathematical talent. So that's where you get your mathematicians, right? Well, in the Philippines, we think everyone should learn how to draw a horse. I don't know if you've ever tried to draw a horse. It's not easy. I cannot.
I asked Joe Staten to draw a horse in a 1977 comic book story, and he still holds it against me.
It's not easy to draw a horse. So apparently that's where the Filipinos got all their artists from that test.
Yeah.
So the PXs have something to do with the spread. Paper rationing has something to do with the spread. Not so much the thing that makes the comic books downstairs so scarce, which was the paper drives to recycle it, but it was really hard to get a hold of paper during World War II. Like many other things, some of it was needed for war purposes and some of it was being profiteered on. And guys like Donenfeld had interesting relationships with groups of people who had previously been in the business of bringing another difficult to get substance into America that came from Canada. alcohol. A lot of the newsstand distribution business in America was in trucks that had previously been used for bringing booze in during Prohibition.
And remained, and distribution remained tied to the mobs in a lot of cities for ever in Chicago and Kansas.
Quite a number of years thereafter.
Yeah.
Well, these guys who were used to bringing things in from Canada were pretty good at bringing paper in. And if you could figure out how to get paper legally or illegally, you could sell almost anything that was printed on it. And that was a big trick of the comic book industry in those years. There just wasn't nearly as much competition. Of course, we're before television. You have radio for entertainment, but...
Yeah, radio, movies, you know, Life magazine, Liberty, you know, you had a few. Yeah. There wasn't a big selection, and comic books weren't just selling to kids. You know, there were... again, there were a lot of GIs were buying them, but there were probably in the early 40s there were a lot more adult readers of comic books than you would think, you know, than you would think from the way things are today.
You also have to think about it. In the early 1940s, I don't know the exact percentage of Americans who were going to college, but it probably was closer to 10% than the 50% or 60% it is now, and the percentage of Americans who weren't graduating high school was a very significant percentage. You dropping out and going to work at 12 and 14 and 15 was a very commonplace situation. The labor laws were accommodating for it at the time. And just coming out of the Depression, families really needed the income. So it was very commonplace. Almost all of the first generation writers and artists in comics hadn't gone to college. It's a very rare exception to have one who went even for a short period of time.
Yeah, they came out of, you know, think places like High School of Art and Design or whatever, and they would go
on the streets.
And they would go straight to the, you know, there were a ton of packagers around who specialized in coming up with comic books that they sold just to, you know, publishers. Jules Feiffer wrote a great book in about 1965 called The Great Comic Book Heroes, and part of it, most of it was dedicated to reprinting Golden Age stories, which in 1965 we had never seen. You either saw the original comic book or you didn't see these stories. They just didn't, you know. So he reprinted the origins of Superman, Batman. I saw the Spirit there for the first time, Plastic Man, all these great classic strips. But his introduction is afterward were about breaking into the comic industry in the 1940s. And it was such a grand, romantic, you know, broke, cheap-ass kind of business that it was just like, there's no way I'm not doing this, you know. And he just made it sound so glamorous. You know, these guys jam together in hotel rooms that they take over the weekend to produce a 64-page comic book. And, you know, they take turns sleeping in the bathtub, and they pry tiles off the bathtub, you know, off the bathroom wall to build little fire pits to heat, you know, beans in the can to eat while they were working over the week. It's like, yes, I want to do that, you know. But that was the industry in those days. It was really, it was a cheap, down and dirty. It was the successor to the pulp magazines, which were also cheap, down and dirty. And, you know, and DC was, in those days, was the, you know, the leader of the pack.
Depending on the year, the number one or number two publisher for almost all of its history,
and surely they had more titles coming out than I know. Fawcett had a lot of books, but I think DC must have had a.
Yeah, I think DC had a larger line than Fawcett in most of those years.
Yeah. And Superman, you know, Superman broke through very early on the radio by 1940.
Mm-hmm.
The show was on the air, and the newspaper strip also started in 1939, I think. Yeah.
Almost immediately.
Yeah. So you know, Superman was a breakout, way bigger than, you know, it's hard to imagine because when things break out today, they break out for about an hour and a half, and they're big and they're everywhere. But Superman had this kind of slow, you know, like over two or 3 years.
I wouldn't say slow. I mean, I think the difference is when something becomes culturally dominant right now, it's almost always an orchestrated marketing campaign.
Right.
You have something that becomes spontaneously a fad, an Angry Birds, because the game is fun. But it doesn't dominate the culture. It doesn't immediately happen in five or six different media forms. And that was still possible then. We were a marketing-saturated and advertising-saturated culture, and it really erupted in a very different way.
You can see that just from the cover. You know, Action Comics, Superman was on the cover of number one, and then what, number like four. Or six?
Yeah.
And I think in the first 11 issues, he was on the cover maybe two or three times.
Well, until they had the sales figures.
And they had the sales figures, and then suddenly it was like, oh, okay. And then Superman took over the covers.
And they did it, put him in his own comic, which had never been done before. There was never comics that, up until that time, always been anthologies. The idea of doing a whole comic book of one character was a radical concept. And, of course, I think that one caught on.
Yeah. I hear there'll be a second issue. Or a 93rd reboot. I forget which it is, but yeah.
Well, there'll be another Superman number one way or another. They did make number one this year, didn't they? Yeah. Anyway, things went fairly well for the comic book companies, particularly for DC.
Not so much for some of the creators, but those are other stories.
I know.
It was actually. I'm.
There's a couple of sides to that story.
Yes. No. I know.
The end of the war, the GIs come back en masse, and they're finding new things to do and new things to spend money on.
And going to college because of the GI Bill.
They're going to college, they're getting married and suddenly having kids almost instantly. The baby
still took 9 months even then.
Sure.
I'm just telling. Yeah, pretty sure. Yeah. Okay.
I thought they were more efficient back then. Never mind. And the comic book industry really gets plastered. DC, Superman is still very strong, but the rest of the superhero line is declining really fast. By 1951, it's only Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman left standing. DC has moved into a lot of comics that tie to radio shows, because those are popular things. Lots of funny animals, lots of westerns.
Romance?
They start the romance a moment or two after that.
Yeah.
They start the war comics at about that time. Our memories are short enough that only 5 or 6 years after the war, we're kind of nostalgic about it.
Well, it only took 20 years for Hogan's Heroes, so, you know.
And the DC comics of the period are kind of clean-cut kids stuff.
The Comics Code had come in the early 50s after, or late 40s, early 50s, after the Wortham.
54.
54. So right after, there were comics that were kind of, I mean, again, by today's standards, you know, not so much. There's nobody getting arms ripped off or things like that. But there was still some, yeah. But, all this stuff was blown out of proportion. The few companies that did publish that stuff were way outnumbered by DC and Marvel, who were basically, you know, pretty much clean cut and aimed at kids. But that took a lot of starch out of just storytelling in general, because suddenly if Phantom Stranger was introduced in that period.
Mm-hmm.
And the Phantom Stranger is a great character. We've both written him. And at the time, he should have been a magical, mystical thing, but you weren't allowed to, you know, you couldn't portray the supernatural as being real. You couldn't, you know, vampires, werewolves, none of this stuff is real. We were not allowed to use zombies or any of that stuff until, what, 70s, you know, something.
One of the really important things to think about when you're thinking about the history of comics compared to what's going on now is that when comics in America began, and to some extent even worse, as Paul's talking about in the 1950s, many of the tools that enable creative people to do important and meaningful stories were not allowed. There was no race. There was no ethnicity. There was no religion. There were really no differentiations by gender. There was the original editorial codes for companies like DC had lines in them that were sort of, and the women can't be depicted as important roles in the story, even if they were the central character. You know, Wonder Woman was the secretary of the Justice Society, taking notes on the adventures. She couldn't participate fully with the guys. There's certainly no sexuality. We're not even talking about heteronormative, you know, all-American classic boy meets girl sexuality. There was no real death. There was no disease. There was no sense of mortality. So the storytelling tools that you might have to create stories of great impact, to look at the human issues that we all care about, you were writing in mittens. And the code made all of that much worse for the industry as a whole.
And there weren't a lot of people trying, frankly, you know, to do much. I mean, there were only a few guys who were making an attempt to kind of elevate it at that point. That really didn't, you know, kind of...
Yeah, the industry perceived itself as
kids' books.
Kids' books and safe kids' books.
Yeah.
And regular kids' books were safe, too. I mean, if there was any element of many of these things in a children's book that you were reading in those years, it's something you look back on now and you shudder at how it was presented. But it was all very, very bland. And the business suffered from both the fact that it was for kids, from Wortham and the efforts to mark the industry as being bad for kids. There's a concept in America called Comstock panics, or media panics. It goes back to a man named Anthony Comstock, who, going back to condoms actually, went through a battle to make sure that people should not know about these terrible things called condoms. You should not be allowed to send that information through the mail. It's filthy. And ever since his time, we've had 7 or 8 media panics where whatever the new medium is at the time, movies, rock and roll, television, video games, comic books, gets blamed for the social ill of the time. In comic books time, it was defined as juvenile delinquency, because we had this whole new generation of young kids growing up in the baby boom, and some of them were sons of bitches.
And they read comic books, and some of them also ate peanut butter, and yet
comics were blamed and not peanut butter.
Yeah.
Personally, we suspect peanut butter was really at fault.
I think
I can't prove it.
Without the jelly, what's the point? So, but anyway.
So if the jelly is an antidote?
The jelly would be the antidote.
If you take it at the same time.
The same.
Is that true? Was it equally safe whether it was grape or strawberry? Or is there an issue here?
Well, that's personal preference. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to judge people. Actually, I do want to judge you, but just not out loud. In my head, every single one of you has been judged and found wanting. But that's okay. Go ahead.
So we're in the late 1950s. The comic book publishers, in general, are doing What company called Western Publishing is packaging books for Dell, starring the Disney characters, and he's doing very well with those. Those are probably the best-selling comics of the time. And the next best-selling thing is Superman coming from DC, partly because there's now a Superman TV series starring George Reeves, which is being syndicated all over the place. And again, it's perceived to be a kids' program, but very, very successful. Very enduring. It lasted. It stayed in syndication for a very long time. The editors at DC aren't really thrilled with a lot of what they're publishing. Dobie Gillis, The Honeymooners, Miss Beverly Hills, a lot of junk. And they're searching for new ideas, and they borrow one of the things that Dell Western is doing. Dell Western has a book called Four Color, which is different every issue or two, showing off different ideas, and from that, generating new things. So DC cheerfully steals the idea, rebrands it as Showcase, and gives it to the group of editors and says, well, each of you do an issue, do it about something. Who knows, something else might work. The first incredibly exciting issue is about firemen.
Fireman Farrell.
This doesn't work. We are not up to Fireman Farrell issue 900. your Fireman Farrell collector's item number one probably sells for something more than it's worth. If you find it in the dealer's room downstairs, don't buy it. It's really not worth reading, and it's not a great investment. You bought one once, right?
I had, yeah. I had the whole that. I had the whole run of Showcase at one point.
I never gave into a Fireman Farrell.
You had to. Yeah, if you're going to have the run, you need the run. But, you know, then you got Call of the Wild.
That was very exciting, too.
And then you get, wait for it, boys and girls, Frogmen. One of the biggest shows on TV at the time was called Sea Hunt, starring Lloyd Bridges, about a guy who was a scuba diver and had adventures and gasped a lot. And
the TV show was much better than the comic.
Yes, yes. And then number four came along, and they gave it to Julie Schwartz, and said, why don't you try bringing back one of the, they didn't call it Golden Age, but one of our old characters. It's been 5 years since we published The Flash. Why don't you try bringing that back? And Julie took the assignment because that's what you do. And rather than just reviving the Jay Garrick helmet on the head, you know, helmet Flash, he decided to revise it, to revamp it, and you know, bring it up to date. And he and writer Bob Kaniger created the Barry Allen version, and
artist Carmine Infantino,
and with Carmine Infantino and Joe Kubert inking the first story so beautifully, and there's a scene in that first story, by the way, which those assholes at Marvel Movies stole for the first issue, for the first Spider-Man movie. Where the tray is falling in the diner, and Spider-Man at super speed, you know, grabs everything, puts it on, and puts it back in the waitress's hand, and she goes, "Oh my goodness, I thought I dropped it." That's a direct ripoff from the Flash origin, and now because of that, Flash can never use the best scene in his own origin if there's ever a movie, because everybody goes, "Oh, you stole that from Spider-Man." No, the other way around. Get that off my chest. I'm a fanboy. Go ahead.
So sad.
Yeah. Come on. Tell us some of the things that you got to complain about on those levels. You've got them.
No.
You got them.
I don't complain. I don't bitch.
Well, that's right. That's my job. Okay.
From that rolled out the Silver Age of comics.
Although some will date it to the appearance of Martian Manhunter as a backup feature in House of Mystery or
Detective.
House of Secrets.
Detective.
Oh, it's not right. Detective and
yes,
right. I know the stuff. I just sometimes the details get a little fuzzy with me. You wrote the book. He wrote the book. Well, I haven't read it yet because I can't afford to hire the guy to hold it for me. But that like 92-pound history of the DC universe.
75 DC years of DC Comics, The Art of Modern Mythmaking. It only weighs 16 pounds.
Only 16 pounds.
A smaller...
You have that leaning on your testicles while you're reading for an hour. No.
You aren't going to use them for anything at all.
A good point, but still the discomfort.
A smaller, somewhat less expensive edition of the book will be coming out later this year or early next year for those of you who require your reading material to be under 16 pounds in weight.
Who lack the upper body strength to read.
It contains many, many good and useful anecdotes.
It does. It's a great book and definitely worth reading. Definitely should be read.
And... yeah, so that gives you basically the first half of DC history. We should now probably allow some of you who have put up with us for this long to ask some questions. And if we run out of questions, then we'll give you the second half of DC's history.
I'm not sure if you talked about it before I got here.
We were talking mainly about you before you got here.
Your book, Jiu-Jitsu?
Yeah, that's not DC, but...
I know, but I'm...
We haven't explained who he is.
I'm looking for it here in the...
Oh, I have not seen it. I'm actually trying to... I just wrote the publisher to get the rights back, to see if I can get the rights back and to republish it. So hopefully... I don't. It's out of print, so I'm hoping to... But thank you.
Yeah, and go back to the late 40s, 50s, and 60s. Where does EC fit in all of this? You mentioned not being able to do horror stories, but... EC was totally based on horror stories.
And driven out of business by the code.
Yeah.
EC, in a complicated series of events, EC comics was what was left of a line of comics that was merged into DC called All-American Comics. A man named Max Gaines, who was one of the men who helped invent the physical format for the comic book many, many years ago, had launched a joint venture with Donenfeld and Leibowitz, the principals of DC, called the All-American. That's where Wonder Woman and Flash and Green Lantern all were launched. When he sold out, he kept a title called Picture Stories for the Bible, started a couple more utterly forgettable comics called...
Cowboy Romance and stuff, or that come later? That was...
Moon, a Girl, Moon Romance.
Yeah.
And he branded the line Educational Comics, EC Comics. Gaines was unfortunately killed young in a boating accident, and his college-age son, Bill, inherited the business. Ultimately the publisher of Mad Magazine. Bill took over the line, rebranded it Entertaining Comics, brought in two editors, Al Feldstein and Harvey Kurtzman, who were Feldstein arguably the most commercial editor of comics of his generation and the very commercial editor of Mad Magazine for a later generation. Kurtzman, one of the most brilliant cartoonists and creators of any generation, and the guy who created and developed the original Mad Magazine, the original Mad Comics, and then the original Mad Magazine. And EC became a line of science fiction and horror comics, incomparably well done, that ran from about 1950 to 1955 or so. It was basically driven out of business by Wortham and the Comics Code. Gaines takes his last nickel, borrows some money from his mother, and relaunches the Mad comic book, which was his most successful new title, as Mad Magazine, and makes his fortune that way. And then ultimately sells it to DC, or sells it to somebody who then sells it to DC in about 1963, leaving it as part of DC. So utterly peculiarly, I ended up as his successor as the publisher of Mad Magazine, with really not nearly enough of a sense of humor to be in the room with those guys. Next question. We don't have any questions.
Oh, there you go.
From the 40s through the 60s, there were only four comic book characters, I believe, that were published continually all through the period.
Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow, and Aquaman.
No. The fourth one was Black Hawk.
My question is,
what happened to Blacko? He was immense. It was immensely popular. It was the second best-selling comic book in the early 50s.
Says who? Says who?
I don't know. One of the sources that we look at.
I don't think they're right. I mean, Black Hawk was a very successful title for a very long time. Paul didn't count it, and I wouldn't count it as...
Superhero.
As a superhero.
Yeah. It's genre stuff. It's adventure, you know.
Yeah.
It was a great strip, and it was successful until 63 or 64.
Yeah.
At that point, kind of the steam was running out of it.
Yeah.
Dick Dillon, who was the artist on it for many years, stayed on it for about another 4 years. But they started a series of really incredibly stupid stories, where they made them into, quote-unquote, the junk heap heroes.
Yeah.
Gave them sort of semi-superpowers, but pretty stupid ones.
Yeah.
And just beat the crap out of it.
Yeah.
And it got canceled in 67 or 68. Been revived a couple of times. A really nice run by Mark Evanier and Dan Spiegel
Beagle,
at one point that you can probably find some copies of down there.
And at some point there was that novel... Bill Rotzler, yeah. There was a Black Hawk novel that there was rumor. We always heard that Spielberg had expressed interest.
It was optioned for him.
Yeah,
Spielberg was a big Black Hawk fan, and
and the novel was rushed out to take advantage of it, and it reads like it, but still.
Is that why we did the novel?
That's what I've always heard. That it was kind of like to support. To show a little, to throw a little support behind Black Hawk because there was the media, you know, there was the
it's
movie
possible.
Interest.
It's possible. I remember the negotiation for that movie deal. That was pretty interesting. Finding an old Black Hawk movie poster at one of the conventions as a closing gift from the lawyer who was on the other side of the negotiation of that. And Warner Brothers held on to the rights for a lot of years, waiting for the day when it was on Spielberg's I'll get around to it list.
Now Tom Hanks is going to play Black Hawk. So.
Yes, sir.
I have a question. I loved your work in Legion of the Heroes.
Bless you.
Legion of the Heroes fan. Is there a reason why they can't seem to catch the popularity of like Teen Titans? It seems as though they're kind of, you know.
Clearly, God's got a point of view on this.
He's a Marvel fan.
You know, I grew up an enormous Legion fan. I can't read your sign, sir.
It says 5 minutes.
Excellent. Thank you. You still have your eyes.
I'm moderating.
You're not very moderate.
I'm not moderate about anything except diet. I can read a clock. Sort of.
I think the Legion core concept was an absolutely wonderful one. It hasn't had an execution in the last few years that has worked to the same level. When I was a kid in the 1960s, Legion was outselling Batman. In those years, if you had anything with a Superman shield on one of the characters, Lois Lane could outsell Batman. So I can't tell you that it was Legion's own success that was doing it, or whether it was just feeding off the success of Superman.
I think there's also some aspirational aspect of the Legion in those days as well. That, you know, they were teenagers, and, you know, an 11-year-old doesn't want to read about another 11-year-old. He wants to read about a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old. So, you know, I think that played a large part of the popularity in those days, because there weren't a lot of teenage superheroes who weren't sidekicks.
Yep. In the 1980s, when I was writing at Legion...
That's a Geiger counter. I think we're all, like, in trouble. Anyway...
You have a problem with radioactivity?
No, I feel I could use that glow, you know.
In the 1980s when I was writing it, it was DC's second most profitable book behind Teen Titans for most of those years. It has not, sadly, had the same level of success in more recent years, including some of the stuff I wrote. So, I don't know.
One last question. Yes.
So you talked about the what was going on with Batman going into 1966, and what did that do to Batman sales?
Going into the launch of the Adam West Batman TV show, Batman sales were trippy. You know, it was not DC's worst-selling book by a long shot, but it probably wasn't selling any better than Black Hawk.
I have heard that one of, like, Detective or Batman was on the threshold of... No?
Not based on numbers that I ever saw.
Okay.
I mean, I heard the same story, not from anyone who was involved,
mm-hmm.
but the numbers don't really support it. But the TV show hits, and in 2 seconds flat, the thing that really determined profitability for comics in the 1960s was what percentage of the copies you printed sold, because it was, you put out comics on what was called a fully returnable basis, because understand guys didn't know what the hell they were carrying. You just sent them a bale of comics. They sent you back a small bale of unsold comics. And by 1966, if you sold one out of two copies of a comic book, you were making good money. You were happy as a publisher. Life was wonderful. Batman had been selling probably 4 out of 10 at that point, and it went up to selling about 99% of its print run.
And what types of numbers are we talking about in print runs in those days?
For Batman, it probably had been 400,000 copies an issue, and then it went up to close to 1 million copies.
So that was selling 1 million copies, close to 1 million copies a month.
An issue.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around anything that could create that kind of buzz today. It's,
It was a different world.
It was. It was Beatles, Bond, and Batman in those days. And,
Batman's unique in having had three moments at which he was the dominant figure in American popular culture, each 20 years apart, which is no other character from any medium has ever done that. The 1960s show, the first of the Tim Burton movies with the bat symbol t-shirts when nobody could get a black t-shirt in this country. And then again, the second of Chris Nolan's Batman movies when Heath Ledger so conveniently died. And it really, really rocketed to the center of the culture and became not just the number one movie for the year, but really a cultural phenomenon.
And that...
I'm sorry, there are lots more stories we could tell, but somebody else has to tell stories now.
And thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
And we're going to be, you know, down on the floor at my table. Paul will be around as well, so come by and ask the rest of your questions.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we have to talk to each other, really.
Oh, God, not again.
Thank you, sir.